This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is Thursday, September 20th in the year 2001. I'm at Charlie Davidson's home in, is this Madison or Monona?
Madison.
This is Madison on the lake, a beautiful view of the Capitol. I'm looking at it right now. And we're going to talk about Charlie's career at the university. Before we get to the university, let's go back a little bit and talk about your a little bit about your childhood and your early years of schooling. Where were you born? How big was your family? Where did you go to school?
Born in Washington, D.C. My dad worked for the post office department. I have one brother, but he's 15 years older than I. He was away in college before I could recognize him. So mother said she brought up two only children. Went to high school there. It was in high school that I began to get interested in physics. I had been advanced in elementary school. I was far too young to go out for football type of things. I remember spending quite a bit of time in the library at high school and doing some reading and reading about some of the famous physicists, and the ideas intrigued me very much. So when it came time to go to college, I decided I wanted to major in physics.
Before you get to college, did you have any high school teachers who guided you in that area or served as mentors?
Not in that area. Probably the closest thing was an English teacher who went through a thorough study of Burke's speech on conciliation with the American colonies and pointed out the logic of his points and the case that he made. And apparently that appealed to me in nobody particularly in physics at that point.
So physics was just an interest that you developed rather independently and pursued on your own. Great. And you went to the American University, which is in Washington,
yes.
D.C. And was that, did you consider any other schools?
Well, they offered a half-tuition scholarship. No.
No, okay.
At that time, the College of Liberal Arts out on the campus was a college of 300 students.
Mm-hmm.
It's now well over 10,000,
mm-hmm.
but it was an ideal place to get personal attention from mm-hmm. the faculty.
Mm-hmm. What year did you begin college?
37 to 41.
Okay, so you came in with an interest in physics. How were you able to pursue that interest at American?
4 years of physics, 3 years of chemistry, no biology, which my wife has regretted. And again, when I graduated and applied in some grad schools, Wisconsin was the only place that offered me a teaching assistantship.
Were there any professors, again, at American who in physics who influenced you and who?
The second man, the man who replaced the one who had been there first, had actually come from Wisconsin, yes. And knew about the place, and it may well be that he wrote a letter about me to the committee that
mm-hmm.
helped me get in. So I had heard something about it from there.
Okay.
But I didn't know anything else about the university.
Okay. So you came to Madison. Did you visit the campus before you?
No.
So you
no.
just came cold.
I rode the bus.
You rode the bus. Oh, that's interesting. What'd you bring? How many things did you bring? One bag or one bag?
Yeah.
Where did you put your stereos and your televisions and things like that?
The interest in music developed later, actually due to WHA radio station on campus.
So you came to Madison. Were you determined to major in physics at Madison?
Yeah.
Okay, we were talking about any professors who influenced you at the University of Wisconsin in physics. Or courses that inspired you.
I finished my master's degree but in the following year Pearl Harbor happened. I continued to study and teach as an instructor, as a lab assistant for a couple of years, but I had long been convinced of the futility of war and was a conscientious objector. And after 2 years of writing it out with the department requesting my deferment, I told the chairman, Rollison, that I just assumed that he didn't ask that again. So I was drafted that year, spent 2 years in civilian public service. After the war, I spent a year teaching at the University of Virginia. It had happened, my release had happened late enough in the year so that I had to grab for something. After that, 2 years as an engineer at Continental Electric in Geneva, Illinois, where I learned a little more about electric circuits, and then came back to Wisconsin to try to resume work on my doctor's degree.
Did you, that course that you taught at Virginia, was that in physics?
General physics.
General physics, yes. Okay.
The physics department here had been very strong in nuclear physics, and a good chunk of the department went down to Los Alamos to develop what eventually we found was the atomic bomb. And after the war, some of them had come back, but even so, that was their primary concern. I was not interested in nuclear physics. After about a year there, I had been doing some reading, even went down in Continental Electric, about digital computers, in particular the EDSAC being built in Britain. I saw an announcement on a telephone pole of an evening lecture to be given by Professor Rideout of electrical engineering on Philbrick analog computers. Well, it had the word computer in it. So I went to visit to see that. I was interested, but it wasn't the digital computers that I had been reading about. I went up to Rideout after the lecture and said, is anyone in your department working in digital computers? He said, no, but we would like to. I said, I've been doing some reading on it. I'd like a chance to get to work on it. He said, why don't you go see the department chairman, Harold Peterson? So I did in the next few days, told Harold what my interest was. He said, no, we don't have anything going, but he pulled out a drawer and said, I have here a grant from Wharf for an assistantship to build a machine to work on a machine to solve differential equations. Now, if you build a general purpose digital computer, you could use that for differential equations, couldn't you? I said, sure. So I got the assistantship, which I have always claimed is the classic case of the spirit, not the letter of the law. I was still keeping my assistantship. Oh, I had been keeping the assistantship. With this, I was able to come over to electrical engineering. I had gotten acquainted with Gene Amdahl, who was also a grad student in physics. His department chairman, his major professor, had gotten him an appointment down at Aberdeen Proving Ground to work on the EDVAC, which was the successor to the ENIAC. And while there, he speculated on what was wrong with the current crop of computers and how he could do better. And when he came back, he and I got to discussing the stuff. He was glad to find somebody else who knew the terminology even. And we kind of honed an idea for a magnetic drone computer. I will have to say from the beginning that the fundamental ideas were his. We gave a joint presentation to an electrical engineering colloquium describing this computer that we claimed could be built inexpensively in short term, not one of the fastest, but would have a lot of new ideas in it. The department was, at least the computer interested people in the department were very concerned, very intrigued. Vince Rideout, Analog Computers, Harold Peterson, the chairman, who had worked with analog computers back in General Electric, not electronic, but the mechanical style. And Rideout and Peterson And Gene and I, with Marv Warple from WARF, drove up to St. Paul to discuss with Engineering Research Associates, one of the few manufacturers of magnetic drones, the ideas for this design. We kind of scared ERA when Gene started talking about features for a recirculating, or revolver as they called it, where information would be written on a drum and picked up again by a reader one word later and recirculated. Because that was a feature in the design of a machine they were building for the Navy. And Gene finally convinced them that it was his original idea. He hadn't gotten it from the Navy. So they finally accepted that UW put in an order for the magnetic drum, and we were started. We continued to work on the design, both for the logic and for the circuits, till the drum came. We could start putting things together. We got a room up on the third floor of the Electrical Engineering Building. I did not know as much about the circuitry, but I was getting very deeply into the logic design. Gene finished his thesis in 61 on the design of the computer. I did mine, I'm sorry, in 51. I did mine on testing methods and mathematical procedures.
Mathematical procedures and testing methods for an intermediate speed digital computer. That was the title of it.
And Gene left to take a position in IBM, and I was trying to head up the project. We were getting additional grad students to work on the thing.
Did Gene stay in contact at all after he left on WISC?
Very, very little.
Okay.
Gene was an incurable optimist. He laid out a schedule, a timetable for the completion of the project, for which the first circuits were just being built when he left, of 3 months to finish building the circuit and a month to test it out, and the whole thing be working in 4 months. Well, in 5 years it was. There's no question of his ideas. They just came bubbling out like from a spring, but not as good at applying. Well, it was realized that I was not as good at applying this stuff in circuitry, electronic circuitry. And they suggested that I go up to numerical analysis lab in basement of Bascom Hall, where Fred Gruenberger was the director. They had some punch card equipment. While we were there, they got the card program calculator. In order to learn some things about the use of the computer in solving mathematical problems. While some of the other fellows back in electrical engineering went ahead with the actual circuitry building. And that included Dave Noble, Al Sidmore came along a little later. He had been in chemical engineering but switched over to this. But I enjoyed working with Fred. He again was a man with lots of new ideas, wanting to try things. He had started, and I helped him produce a newsletter, again run on ditto machines, called Computing News. And it got up to several hundred issues, as a matter of fact, went around the country of people who were using these punch card machines. I helped write some of the articles for that.
So that was a national thing, geared toward people who were interested in using the punch card computer?
Yeah.
Great.
Fred had only a master's degree and was not interested in pushing ahead for a doctor's. By then, the computing division of the mathematics department wanted to build up a separate, specialized area of research and academic pursuits and brought in Preston Hammer, who had been at Los Alamos, head of the computing center there. My summary of Preston Hammer is that he contributed almost nothing to the development of the computing here. He was much more interested in developing a department with courses and academic standing. He squeezed Fred Grinberger out because Fred did not have a doctor's degree, therefore could not supervise graduate students. Fred went to Hanford, Washington, worked for Atomic Energy Commission on that computing stuff. But I never got along with Preston Hammer very much. In later times, I recall one of the committee meetings campus-wide where some new project was being proposed, and I was saying, engineering would like to work on that. And Preston said to the group, "Nobody in engineering knows anything about computing." As you can imagine, a very popular man with me.
Yeah, right, exactly.
We pushed ahead with the whisk. We had decided.
Perhaps this might be a good point to talk about some of the design features in the WISC computer.
It had several unique characteristics. One, it gained a lot of efficiency and gained speed without adding the amount of circuitry by using serial circuits for arithmetic rather than parallel. Parallel circuits took far more circuitry than the serial. Serial would be much slower unless you could combine the access time to find the next order, to find the operands, and to deliver the result with the actual arithmetic operations. And that's what Gene had realized could be done by guaranteeing that all of the arithmetic operations would be completed in exactly one cycle on the drum, the magnetic drum. He could have four things going on at once. We could be locating the next instruction, locating the two operands called for, A and B, performing the arithmetic, addition, multiplication, whatever, and then the fourth cycle delivering the result. But these could be going on concurrently. First cycle, locate next door instruction. Second cycle, locate next instruction, but locate the operands from the first one. Third cycle, go on with the third next instruction, the next pair of operands, but do the arithmetic. Mm-hmm. And then the fourth cycle, deliver that result while we're doing the arithmetic on the preceding set of operands, while we're locating the set of operands needed for the next one, while we're reading the instructions that we're going to be going on. So that by guaranteeing that everything could be done in exactly one cycle of the drum, we could be doing four things at once. Mm. That was the primary new contribution in Gene's design. We also decided that since the problem of scaling was a horrendous task in digital computers, guaranteeing that no intermediate result would ever get too big for the size of the register and keep them down at a small enough size, one often had to run the problem halfway through to find out how big the numbers got to go back and rescale them before you could start. So by deciding to do everything in floating point, where the significant figures are kept separate from the exponent to be applied to it, this meant we did not have to worry, the programmer did not have to worry about the scaling, you could just go ahead and let the computer take care of it. No computer at that point had ever been built using floating point circuitry in the digital computers. It does make for more complication. One, a third feature on the WISC, which was unique, was the so-called extract instruction, which would allow one to take bits from any part of an instruction word, shift them right or left any number of places, and write them into any other instruction. So you could modify an instruction, and this turns out to be an essential ingredient for using subsequences, where you want to write a sequence of things but have it apply here and have it apply something else somewhere else and so on. So the extract was a very powerful addition to the instruction set. Lastly, we bragged that it was the only significant computer other than commercial ones which had no government money in it.
Mm-hmm. Now you got some of the money from Wharf.
Yeah,
right.
From, I mean, local, internal to University of Wisconsin. When it came time to really build this thing, we decided that we could ease the complexity by first building the arithmetic circuitry fixed point without worrying about all that exponent, which would require shifting a number right or left, I mean, so that the two would have the decimal point or binary point in the right place so you could add them. And that was the way we proceeded, and I think it was a worthwhile decision, because once we had the thing working fixed point, then we could build the floating point and add it to it, which would facilitate programming, but did not cause anywhere near the circuitry problems.
Now, this was in 52 that you started building it?
Yeah.
And Amdahl was a long gone. He was at IBM working on, what was it, the 320 or something like that. Did you assume, who was sort of the engine chief on this thing?
I was the head of the project, except for that time that they moved me up to
numerical
analysis,
to
learn
right.
things about solving mathematical problems. Then I came back and took on the supervision.
So again, you had a wonderful staff of people. Dennis Noble, you mentioned, and Skidmore.
Dave Noble, Elson Moore.
David, right.
Let me see. It's hard to remember which ones were at that point and which ones didn't come in until later. But there were grad students doing the work on it. In fact, that was one of the reasons that the department wanted to tackle this project in the first place, to learn things about it, to give grad student training in computer circuitry.
Yeah. Well, John Asmuth was another name, and Dietmeyer and J.B. Miller and John McNell were other names that
Don Dietmeyer was an undergrad in EE and had been working the construction of the thing, and I got to talking with him. He was a real sharp character, top-notch grades, and I went to Harold Peterson and said, is your feeling about inbreeding strong enough so that you would not want to have a top-notch graduating senior continue as a grad student? He said, fine, love it. Who are you talking about? Dietmeyer. He says, of course. So Dietmeyer joined us. Actually, he did not do the thesis on the WISC, but he spent some time at Bell Labs on some binary circuits, and when he came back, did his thesis on that area. But he did do a lot of the work in the WISC. He, after we finished this, he joined the faculty and has gone up through the ranks, not only to a full professor, but went on beyond me. He was associate dean of the college for some time. He is now retired. He lives across the street. When we got the fixed point portion working, I had been putting some of my mathematical skills from numerical analysis lab to work and designing some programs to solve some basic mathematical problems. including the Runge-Kutta method of numerical integration. I remember writing one program that used fourth order Runge-Kutta integration. The program was written in hexadecimal and punched in on paper tape in binary. But it worked. Not the first time, but it worked. When we got the fixed point system working, but we're starting to build the floating point circuitry, I wrote a program, an interpretive program, which would take input in the format, assuming that the numbers were all floating point numbers. And the software would then take apart the exponent and do the shifting to perform the equivalent of floating point circuitry arithmetic on it, and then convert it back again when they were through. This was the FAIR, or floating arithmetic interpretive routine. It made it an awful lot easier to write programs. It took 80 times as long to run. But the human time saved made it worth it. Most people prefer to do it that way.
Let's talk a little bit about the use of this in electrical engineering and teaching.
The department was very interested in having students introduced to it. And once we had the floating point part working so that students didn't have to worry about that, in a couple of the core courses, we would have their lab instructors come down to to the lab where the WISC was running, and we would give them a quick run through of how you punch the paper tape and how you feed it in and develop the program. And then those instructors would make assignments using it. It got into being required use in three of the core courses, mm-hmm. so that any student had to have it, hit it somewhere. About that point, the rest of the college wanted to get in on the act, the other five departments. And Dean Wendt called me in and said, "Charlie, we like what you're doing there. We put in an order for this new IBM 1620 computer. Have you heard of it?" "Yeah, I've read a little bit about it. I didn't think we could afford it." "Well, we found a pot of money. We would like to set this up on a college-wide basis rather than just electrical engineering, and establish a laboratory where all the students could come in and use it, and we would like you to be the director of that lab." I said, "Sure, I would love it." And that thus was born the Engineering Computing Laboratory in 61.
ECL.
The original input was punch paper tape. IBM had developed, was just coming out on their bigger machines with Fortran, which was proving tremendously popular with the engineers. And they had a kind of a pigeon Fortran developed for the 1620. But their philosophy was backward for what we wanted. They assumed it was going to be for people doing large research problems. When you fed in a problem, the 1620 Fortran compiler chugged away and punched out 20 minutes worth of subroutines on tape. Then they looked at your problem, and if it found any mistakes, bombed out. If it didn't, then they would punch out an executable paper tape, which you could then use to load the tape that had all the subroutines, and then load your problem and run it. The whole thing would take half an hour minimum, and maybe much more. We wanted something where students who have itty-bitty programs, they're just trying to learn about this thing, could go stick it in, find out what that it didn't work, or what's the mistake, fix it up, run it back in again, and finally get the result. The whole problem wouldn't take more than a minute to run once it got going.
You avoid that 30 minutes of...
Well, Charlie McClure was a grad student at that time, and he looked at this design of the computer and of their GoTran, as IBM called it, and said, you know, if we got a second memory module instead of the 20,000 digits that they put in it, get another 20,000 digits, we could compile a program and store the result into memory instead of having to punch it out.
Mm-hmm.
We could keep in that memory the subroutines that are needed. And at the same time, our compiler could find the mistakes and identify the location of those mistakes, not in terms of the executable, exact in the only language that he could understand, the Fortran, where his mistake is. He could fix it, feed in the next version of it, and you'd have his whole problem done in 15, 20 minutes instead of an hour.
Mm-hmm.
In order to teach students how to use this Fortran, which was still a subset of the full Fortran, but had many of the useful features in it that were being found so valuable by the experienced programmers. We started in, rather than bringing students down here to get live lectures, I developed a set of tape-recorded, slide-illustrated lectures on the Fortran and on the computer. The tape would run using signals on the tape which would advance the slide projector at the right time. We originally had 3 45-minute tapes and later got four of them, which included not only what's a computer, what kinds of things can it do, how do you go about writing a program in Fortran, how do you load it into the computer and get it to run. These tapes were set up in a vacant lab so that lecture one would run every hour, Monday and Tuesday. Lecture two, every hour, Wednesday and Thursday, and so on. When an instructor in the college wanted the students to use the computer, he would assign the problem from the book and say, now, go and catch these lectures that ECL is putting on. Here's the schedule when they're being run, and then use it to solve that problem. Once it got running pretty smoothly, I figure that we had about 1,000 students a year for 10 years going through those tapes.
That's amazing.
10,000 students learning how to use a computer.
That's amazing. And this is in the early 70s? 60s, rather. I'm sorry, 61. 61 to 80. So this is through the 60s that you're getting this many students.
Later on, when we were talking with the people running the bigger computing labs, the Mac and the UWCC, and they were describing their procedures for getting people to run and how long it would take to, well, they leave a deck, they didn't put it in themselves, they just leave it on the desk, and people would sometime later on run it for them, and they would come back a couple of hours later to get the comments, which may have had some results, may have had some errors. Fix it up, put it in a second time, so it might be 2 to 3 days before they get the problem run. And I would tell them, yesterday we had 1,600 problems run through our computer. Granted, they weren't the big, long-running super research thing,
right,
but they were part of the instructional program. The students took to this, of course, very eagerly. The faculty were a little slower.
Interesting.
I remember hearing about one faculty member who had lectured for 50 minutes on the solution of a particular problem, 10 minutes after class, a student came up with a printout and said, you want to see how the computer solves it? The college encouraged me to try to reach out to the faculty, and we ran some special faculty workshops, like over Thanksgiving holidays or weekends, that kind of stuff. And I had a good many of the progressive faculty, including several department chairmen and two deans, take these courses. Mm-hmm. Eventually, it got worked in. The concept from the beginning was, it is an illiterate engineer nowadays who doesn't know how to use a computer and when to use a computer. And that's why we want to be sure that all our students get that experience.
When you were starting the lab in 61 and you were putting all those students through the program, were you in touch with any of our sister Big Ten institutions? Did they have similar types of labs that they were developing at that point?
There was a 1620 users group around the country, which IBM sponsored. When we got Forgo working, we submitted it into the library of the 1620 users group. IBM ran this, and they would send out decks of programs to various people who would want them. And one time there were over 400 colleges in the country who were using Forgo.
My goodness.
There were very few places who were specializing in instruction. Most of the computers were being put to use to do research problems.
Was it Dean Wendt's foresight that helped bring this to bear?
I give him the credit. In fact, I remember when we had had the computer running for 2 or 3 years and turning out results on students like this, he called me in one day and said, Charlie, could you use another computer? He says, I've been playing poker up in the president's office and I got enough money to get another one. So we get a second 1620.
Now, the WISC, I might have read this, maybe it was actually before the ELC opened, but
ECL. The first year we ran the WISC side by side with the 1620.
The 1620, right.
And John McNall had the job of doing maintenance on the WISC. What we did was give him Mondays to go over it and run all the preventive maintenance circuits and find the weak tubes and replace that. And then the rest of the week it was available for use. It turned out that once that 1 week was over, we could keep up 95% scheduled uptime. Mm-hmm. But it was at such an expense.
Yeah, right.
A grad student being paid, he was a project assistant at that time, being paid to do this maintenance. And so we scrapped the WISC. It went down into McNall's basement or garage for a while. Later on, Gene Amdahl, after he got his company going, the Amdahl Corporation, sent a couple people back and said, we'd kind of like to get that old WISC and move it out to California and see if we can't get it working. So they shipped it out there. I believe they did get it working. I didn't keep up with it any further than that.
Last time I saw, I'll send you a copy of this, was a picture of Amdahl in one of his new offices, lobbies, and in the background you could see the WISC.
Ha!
He'd used it as sort of as like a piece of sculpture in the thing. So there was just one WISC built, that was it.
Yep.
I remember reading something about Amdahl. This was back when he was just starting to work on it with you, and talking about possibly getting part of it patented or all of it patented by Worf. Did any of that come about?
No. Worf helped us submit some patent applications, but the main problem is that in those days everything was so fluid and moving so fast.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that had already been designed was out of date.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
The ECL shortly after the beginning of it, we got talked the dean into getting funds to upgrade to a punch card machine rather than the punch paper tape. Not only was it simpler to use, it's an awful lot simpler if you find a mistake to take out one card and put in another one than to take a long string of punch paper tape and patch it. But also, IBM designed their punch card version to overlap the operations. The computer could be running things while it was still reading in cards. Whereas on the paper tape, it had to finish reading all the tape, then do the computing, then punch out the tape. Well, after all, IBM was in the business to sell cards. Well, we got the punch card version, things smoothed up quite a bit, and with two machines on, the second machine, we got still more memory, so that we had a more powerful version. Charlie McClure had done the first one and done a magnificent job. I'm trying to remember. Oh, for people who did not have the extra memory, we developed a special version where we could punch out the intermediate results and then load them back in, but it still had the compiler and diagnostic features on it. We called that Fortugo, the two-pass Fortugo. So that was being circulated through the 1620 users group also.
Throughout the entire operation of the lab, it was pretty much geared toward the undergraduate. Was there a point in which researchers wanted to start getting involved in this operation as well?
Yeah, sure. Grad students were trying to use it and were beginning to submit problems, some of which were too long, use more running time than the undergrad type things and were hogging the circuits. And we had to, I made the decision and ECL put up the rules that said, during these hours of the day, only problems of such and such length can be run. Nighttime maybe, or other hours, they could run some of the longer ones. We had a couple of professors who kept trying to sneak other grad students, have their grad students sneak the longer problems in. I had to get nasty with a couple of them. Our philosophy was, again, grad students need to learn this too, but there have other means of getting this kind of instruction and experience. The undergrads had only this.
I think it's just amazing what support you had from the administration to keep this at the undergraduate level. That's just critical, especially at this point in time where computers are just developing the way there. But you had help in the lab, and I'd like to talk for just a couple of moments about some of the staff that you had over the years and some of the TAs as well. Could you talk a little bit about Verlin Erickson?
Well, we had enough business there so that we needed 8 or 10 assistants, undergrad and grad TAs, who did some maintenance in the early days and did some programming development, but whose principal job was to be in the lab to help the students, to answer their questions, to show them how to do things, to put it in and run it. We got up to where I had a full-time assistant director and a full-time secretary, as well as 6 to 10 teaching assistants, project assistants, as they were called, to do that. Verlin, the first assistant director I had was a girl that I had recruited out of Palm Beach, who was working in a computing center down there, and I'd attended a computing meeting down there, and I got to talking with her and asked her to apply up here. She did, accepted her, and she came on up.
Okay, the person's name was
Joyce Fodor.
F-O-D-O-R?
Right. She at first was just a regular assistant, and I asked the dean for money to make her an assistant director to take over more of the responsibilities, which she did very nicely, helped perform the education for the other students who were running it. The year that I was in Edinburgh, she was the director, the acting director of the laboratory, and did a beautiful job on it. There are a couple of letters in the file from some of the faculty who were praising her for that.
Now, there were a couple of other names that I was able to come up with. Was the one Erickson, and then there was William Lagerus.
Lagerus followed Erickson, yeah. He had been over at Space Astronomy Laboratory. They were successively weaker people, I would say. Did adequate job, but I was spoiled by having Joyce behind the thing. The Dave Wilson was one of the grad students at that time who had learned the machine language program on the Harris machines. Oh, see, it must have been about 1970, 71. We found that we couldn't afford to keep the 1620 going any longer, even on the high discounts that IBM was granting, because it was essentially so much slower machine than the newer things coming along. We looked into two or three of them and found one from Harris Corporation in Florida, which later became, I'm sorry, from Datacraft, which later became Harris, because they had an operating system which we needed in order to do our scale of running. But when we got, when we had the order in for the Datacraft machine, we were worried about Forgo, because they had a Fortran, but not a Forgo type thing. And Dave Wilson said, yeah, I can write you one. And he, in one academic year, before the machine had come, wrote this thing. When the machine came, he needed 3 weeks to get it debugged, and then we opened it up to users. This astounded some of the other computer people on campus, like from Mac and from other places in the College of Engineering. One of them said, you stuck your neck out on this one. I didn't think you could possibly do it, but I'll have to admit you did, and it works. Well, I didn't do it. Wilson did. Yeah. You have talked to him.
Yes, right? I've talked to David Wilson.
I was disappointed that neither McClure nor Wilson ever went on to get his doctorate degree. Charlie got an offer from a company out in the Boston area that just appealed to him too much. Dave Wilson submitted an idea for a thesis into what was then Computer Sciences Department on campus. And they turned it down, saying, Preston Hammer turned it down, saying, this is not new, unique, original, this idea of the load-and-go Fortran, the Forgo thing. And Dave got so discouraged that he just quit trying for it. I said, look, I have professorial status in computer science department. I would be glad to supervise your thesis work, but he was just turned off.
There comes a point sometimes. Yeah. In the years that the lab operated, did you maintain the same space, the same facility space?
No, let's see. The WISC was being built upstairs, and it moved to larger quarters also upstairs, and then eventually down to a space in the basement of engineering building. After the 1620 came in and began to expand operations in terms of the number of students pouring through the place, we got some basic remodeling done there and almost double the space we had available. Did some fairly extensive remodeling of walls, put in a raised computer floor, and that type of, with air conditioning, that type of thing. The interesting thing was that the principal need for air conditioning was not people, was not circuits, it was a punch cards.
Oh, really?
Yep. They would tend to warp and jam.
Of course. So they got the
yeah.
That's great.
For people listening to this tape, I know I have trouble comprehending this too. How big was the whisk? Can you say it in
feet? I can
show
you a picture.
I guess I should really get a picture from you and put it in your folder so that anybody looking at the, listening to this tape can look at that.
I've got one right here.
Okay.
It was, 6 feet long, 6 feet high, 18 inches deep. Well, let's see, the bottom part was more than 2 feet deep because it had the magnetic drum, but the circuitry was maybe 18 inches deep. Gene's idea was that by making it compact but enclosing it completely with all of the doors on, we would have forced draft ventilation through to keep the circuitry cooler.
And that worked?
Yeah.
Did all of the things that Amdahl had designed early on, did they all kind of come to pass the way he had pretty much imagined them? Were there any major changes that you had to make along the way? I'm sure that there was a lot of tightening up and everything.
I don't know about major. Well, one difference was the idea of building the floating point separately.
Mm-hmm. And that was your idea?
Well, the group of us who were planning it discussed and decided that was going to be more sense. I supported it, yeah. I don't know whether I first proposed it or not.
Whatever, yeah.
Yeah, I would say that his design was fundamentally sound, yes. The integral synchronization worked beautifully.
In terms of Amdahl's later career, not only at IBM, but at his own, he designed the Amdahl computer, did he not?
Yeah.
And it was fairly successful.
When he was still at IBM, actually for the second time he had been somewhere else, he was one of the crew that did the design of IBM's system divided by 360,
yeah.
Which was an extremely powerful, successful machine.
Very successful, yeah.
And in that role, he not only learned circuit design, but also administration and economics and how those decisions come in. When he left to form his own company, the Amdahl Corporation, he was able for several years to stay a little bit ahead of IBM in speed and considerably below IBM in the cost of the machines he kept turning out.
Was anything from WISC, from that initial design that he made, did you see any of that go into his later work, or is that impossible to tell?
No, on a serial arithmetic system with a magnetic drum doesn't carry over to a high-speed parallel circuit magnetic core computer.
Okay, getting back to the lab for a moment, you guys had a 20-year run with the Engineering Computing Laboratory. In 1981, your lab was merged with the Data Acquisition and Simulation Laboratory, and it resulted in the Computer-Aided Engineering Center, CAE. I don't know how you pronounce that. CAE?
Yeah.
CAE. Yeah. Could you give me a little bit of a background on how that came about? And
I was not
what led to?
Part of that plan. Dean Bollinger.
New Dean Bollinger at that point. Wasn't he a pretty new dean at that point, 81?
And, he had been a professor of mechanical engineering for some time. And Tad Pinkerton, who was director of MAC, and John Eucher, who had been part of the committee that helped select the computer for the Data Acquisition Simulation Lab.
Okay.
And he was the head of that committee, as a matter of fact. So his advice was sought by the dean and the committee of the three of those, essentially, were the ones who worked this out. I was told later that, frankly, the biggest incentive was that the college couldn't afford to pay a full professor's salary to direct this kind of an operation. And so they were trying to ease me out to find some other place where I could contribute and do work that I was interested in. And they talked with Tad about it, and he said, yeah, there are a lot of things Charlie could do up at MAC for instructional purposes, and that was the title that they gave me. Unfortunately, that year, Tad was tapped for a campus-wide position by the, I've forgotten whether it's a provost or a vice.
It was Irv Shane, I think. I think it was the chancellor, actually.
Chancellor, all right. To be the director for, they've been changing names so much. It's what is now DeWitt was then.
It was Information Technology or something, Office of Information Technology, something like that.
So he left MAC for that position. And the man who succeeded him, Manley Draper, who was an administrator under him, became the director. Let's see, he did not have anything like the vision and was not as interested in instruction that Ted had been. And although I had a couple projects that I worked on, none of them were exactly what I had wanted to do. I wanted to develop a Forgo for one of their big computers. And they said, well, Burroughs claims they have a diagnostic compiler. I don't know why we need this. And I said, I don't care much for the features of it. I spent one semester trying to teach using it and got really turned off. To back up, when I was relatively first starting at ECL, when we got Forgo running, I got to talking with Eldo Koenig.
Eldo Koenig?
Eldo Koenig had been an engineer with Alec Chalmers in Milwaukee, and Mac had brought him over to be on their staff. Since Koenig was an engineer and had been good friends with Vince Rideout, I'd gotten to know him, and we got to talking about the teaching situation, and Koenig and I proposed that we could develop a course where not just any engineering student, as we had been proving, but any undergraduate student in the university could learn about computers. So we built up this course, Computer Science 132. At first we had a mathematics requirement on it, and later even dropped that. Said any undergraduate student could take it. And I taught this course for 20 years. It was roughly what are computers, what kinds of things can they do, how do you talk to them and tell them what to do, and what are the things that they're being used for in the world around us. But I insisted that the students have to run at least one problem on a computer. You cannot understand the intelligence level or the lack of it on a computer until you've tried to talk to it. The first year, I had the students come over to ECL to run on Forgo. By then, the Mac was developing some remote terminals whereby people could submit jobs into the principal computer and get their results back. And from then on, they were running on that. But the Fortran available for that had very little diagnostic. So Draper wanted me to try out Burroughs' diagnostic Fortran, and I did teach with it one semester, and I said, no, it is no good. I don't want to try to use this. But we were stuck with having to use whatever Mac would make available for the students to try to run their programs. Granted, they were not heavy users, one short, simple program. Mm-hmm. But the course got to be quite popular. The School of Business required it for 2 or 3 years.
Oh, really?
And I had, at one time, 500 students at a time going through the thing, 12 or 13 TAs to have to supervise.
That's amazing.
Let me add that in the prospect of working with those TAs, having weekly staff meetings to go over with them what we're covering next, what I want them to stress, how I want them to do it, how to make up exams, what we want to cover, how, what kind of a grading system we're going to be using, scaling the grades. I feel that I was teaching two courses, one of the students mm-hmm. and one of the TAs.
Well, you were.
And I feel that I was making a significant contribution mm-hmm. from the teaching point of view to them.
Well, that was sort of the leaf motif, the theme running through your entire years.
Yes.
Was you were more or less the champion of the undergraduate,
yeah.
which could also be the champion of the underdog when you have the research yes. people coming along. And
the championing of the popular concept and understanding of computers.
Mm-hmm.
As I taught 132, I worked quite a bit of computers and society into it.
Mm-hmm.
In topics such as computers and the threat to privacy.
Mm-hmm.
National Science, ACM sponsored me for a few years.
American Council of?
Association for Computing Machinery.
Oh, okay.
I'll talk
right.
more about that
okay.
in a minute.
Okay.
But I was running two lecture series open to invitation.
So you had two courses you were teaching. One was on privacy, computers and the threat to privacy.
Threat to privacy, and one was on computer simulation and limits to growth,
mm-hmm.
built on the Club of Rome book that had recently mm-hmm. come out. So all this period I was quite concerned with the concept of computers and society, mm-hmm. computers in society. After several years of doing this, the then chair of computer sciences department, Larry Travis, said, I have a request from the extension division to do some lectures in the continuing education series.
This was in 1979, about, yeah.
Sounds like it, about that. The Extension Division running these continuing education courses, and I mounted a few of them. No one going repeatedly, but I did several different ones. One was on privacy.
Computers and teaching, computers for everyone, I have the names here, computers in society and computers in our state government.
Yeah.
Who was the audience on these, basically, an extension?
Well, for the state government, I had talked to Fred Risser, and he sent one of his staff people down. I'd known Fred from back in the mm-hmm. days of square dancing. His dad was a square dance caller. Privacy was pretty much all over, some people from state government. One of my greatest disappointments was the computers and teaching. I was aiming it at the public school teachers, and I got no takers.
Really?
Zero. They weren't being paid for it. And those people don't have the concept of using their time to advance themselves. That was canceled.
Amazing.
Yep.
That's
I had been
amazing.
Working with a couple people down in the Board of Ed in advising them on some computers in the schools. During that period of time, my wife, Hermine, was on the Board of Education, and I was in this advisory to the staff of the Board of Ed on computers and their usage and in introducing them, primarily trying to get the teachers to be willing to touch these things. But eventually we made some progress and the schools are now using
it. That came rather fast. Were you, what were you doing in the early, when was it when the PCs first started being introduced, in the early 80s, 81, 82, 83? Did you play an active role in
no,
that?
No, not very. I had not even started using them in 132. When Travis asked me to do this extension division programming business, I said, gee, but what do I do with my regular course? Who on earth can we get who would like to teach that? And Travis said, I would. So he taught it for the last couple of years there. It still had, I don't think he had introduced the PCs as yet. They were just beginning to come in. And as I left that course and the department, one of the other faculty members was introducing the idea for a new course using PCs and some of their capabilities for 5 credits instead of 3. It got chopped down to 4 credits, but I did say that I would hope very much that you would continue the theme of computers in society as basic part of this course. He was not very enthusiastic. I don't think that took hold very well. I don't even know how the course goes now. Eventually, I lost interest in what computer sciences was doing, the department, and they lost interest in what I was doing, and I left them and came back to the College of Engineering teaching one course in electrical, what was then electrical and computer engineering, on some advanced logic design, and developing a short course in general engineering, which taught mechanical drawing for the rest of the college. There was a program available called...
Is that the AutoCAD?
AutoCAD.
Yeah, that was in 86. You wrote a manual for
AutoCAD,
for teaching AutoCAD.
The chair of the department wanted to try to introduce this, but he knew very well that the instructors he had teaching mechanical drawing were not in a position to really learn how to use this computer system. So, and he had gotten a whole series of the manuals, a whole series of the program, set of programs from the company, the AutoCAD company, but wasn't able to use them. So I was supported for a semester developing a teaching program for that, including a simplified manual and a simplified set of instructions of how you go through, you do this, you get that done, and then the next year they did use that in the mechanical, in general engineering department.
You also had some interesting things that you did. You were, the Governor's Task Force, this is again in 1979-81, that looked at the issue of computerization of the Criminal Justice Information Center. What can you tell me about that task force and your role in it?
Discouraging.
No. How so?
Quite a good many of us spent quite a good many hours at meetings over the better part of a year trying to fight against the police department's interests and the legal aspect of it, the various other departments who were concerned about this, trying to get it to where a person's criminal record after a certain number of years should get buried and eliminated from the file rather than dragged up and thrown out about them. We came in with a whole set of recommendations for this and submitted it to the governor's office, and nothing has ever been heard of it.
Yeah.
So they had you do it, you spent all this time doing it, you turned it in, and then it just vanished and thin air.
But again, it is part of my interest in computers and society.
Now, we're going to go way back for just 1 second and then come back, but we skipped this earlier on, and I do want to get it in. Early in your career, this was 1968 and 1969, you were a visiting professor in the Department of Computer Science and Regional Computing Center at the University of Edinburgh. Could you talk a little bit about that? And you also had some association there with Tad Pinkerton. Could you work that into the...
University of Edinburgh in Scotland was just getting into the Fortran age. They were still using a special developed programming language over there. And the chair of the department and a representative from the Regional Computing Center had come over to Wisconsin, talked to our department about trying to find somebody who would go over there and help them teach that, and I expressed some interest in doing it. So I was interviewed fairly heavily with that. They couldn't make any promises, but said it'd be quite likely. Meantime, I was also applying for some other extended service job. It finally came through in the spring of the year that I would be half-time in computer sciences department teaching a general course like my CS-132 and the other half-time with the Regional Computing Center teaching some short courses in Fortran for them because they were had very few people had experience in that one. And I enjoyed both of those experiences. The year before that, the head of the computer science department at the University of Michigan, Bernie Galler, whom I had known through Association for Computing Machinery, called me and said, "Charlie, I got a grad student who's finishing this year who comes originally from Wisconsin. You might want to talk with him about coming to Wisconsin." So at the next one of the national computer conferences, I got in touch with him, chatted with Tad Pinkerton, and invited him to come to Wisconsin to interview. He accepted, came out here, gave a talk. We had him and his wife for dinner here. And the department liked him, and they made him an offer. Meantime, he had accepted an appointment at Edinburgh with the Regional Computing Center. So we were there together for that year. I figure I had a year to work on him and succeeded and talked him into accepting the position here, which he did take. I think he was a major addition to campus.
Oh, now, yes.
Not only in computer science, but director of the Computing Center, this Chancellor's aide to information technology and so on. So I was fortunate in having that opportunity to get to know him.
And you did the university a huge favor by helping lure him here. Continues to be a real important force on campus. You were a member of the Association for Computing Machinery. Talk a little bit about that organization and your involvement in it.
It was originally a highly academic group. It got started on Columbia University campus back in 1947 to promote interest in information processing and the machines and the computing techniques, information retrieval, automatic control, and promote exchange of information about all these aspects, including to the public. I, when the 1620 came in, IBM was promoting these user groups on campus, and there was a meeting down in Chicago, and the college sent me down to attend that. These are people who had the new 1620s around the Midwest region of the country, and I made a couple of comments in the talks at the thing, enough so that I was elected to be chair of the Midwest region, a 1620 user group. The next step, the American Standards Association was looking, getting into standardization of programming languages. And so the college sent me to a meeting of that was talking about Fortran, which I joined that group and attended for 3 or 4 years. So that one of my claims to fame is that I was a member of the group that did the first standardization of Fortran.
Wow.
Somewhere along the line, at one of these gatherings, there was being formed a special interest group of Association for Computing Machinery on Computing Center Directors. And I got elected to that. I was really out of my depth because I was small potatoes compared to some of the other big computing things. But that's what got me started with ACM and going to other of their meetings. There was a chapter started on campus here, which I was initially slow to get going because I thought that the Engineering Society would cover it. And I, an engineering computer group, I later realized that that was too technical, and so I became faculty advisor to the chapter here, to the student group.
The student group, that was.
And then member of the adult chapter, and served a period as chair of that. As chair of that chapter, I went to a couple of the national ACM meetings and got to know some people there pretty well. When one of the structures of ACM was to have several regional groups, including one from Canada, one from Europe, and some at large, and I was nominated and elected to be chair of the Midwest region of ACM, to the surprise of people who had not heard of me. And as such, I was therefore a member of the ACM International Council and attend those meetings every month. Got to know a lot of people in the computer business, went to the national conferences. I got to know not only the then president, but people who later on moved up to presidency. And before I retired, I knew just about everybody at the top levels in ACM. I had served 2 terms as Midwest Regional Rep to the Council, 2.5 terms, because there was a time when one of the subsequent reps had to drop out, and they asked me if I would fill in his unexpired term, and took over chair of their special interest group on computers and society, which I've always been disappointed it didn't work out as the way I'd liked it. The person who had been the newsletter editor carrying it along fine said, okay, as long as you've been elected, I resign. So I scratched through and picked up somebody I had known, got in touch with somebody I had known from one of the 1620 things and asked him to be newsletter editor. He said, yeah, sure. And he did nothing.
Why did that one person resign?
Oh, Carolyn had done the job for 2 or 3 years and just wanted out.
Okay.
If not, nothing against me.
Right, okay.
I don't think. Several months went by and we didn't get out any newsletters. I had asked Carolyn, who said she wanted to resign, all right, help me put out 1 issue and then you can resign. She did. But then the new guy didn't do anything. I finally put out a one-page thing that I called a news note, news memo, not a newsletter, scratching to try to get somebody else to fill in. Did get somebody else, and he didn't do anything either. So the special interest group did not accomplish very much under my term there. I was sorry to see that happen, because as you can gather from these other things, it is a very strong interest of mine.
That was a good fit, yeah.
But I did get to know a lot of the people in ACM, enjoyed that experience very much, felt that it was doing some very good things in society. I got to travel a lot around the country as far as that goes, but I also got to know an awful lot of the people who were prominent in computing.
Now, on campus, you also served on several computer committees. We don't need to go into all of the
That's
particular
good,
committees.
That's good, because I couldn't name them. But
right. Is there any kind of overarching theme on those committees?
Yeah, again, it's the fight of the instructional interest against research interest. I very frequently had to try to squawk about the way the students were teaching, or argue that there should be more opportunity for them. It was recognized what I was doing at ECL, I was doing a very good job of that, but it was for a tiny subset of the people.
Is this a shift that you saw a lot during you were on campus for a fair number of years? Did you see that shift more toward research?
Well, wasn't
at the expense,
a shift,
or
from the beginning?
From the beginning.
That's what computers were for.
Yeah.
For research in science and engineering, and then very shortly after the first ones of scientific computers, the whole area of data processing in business usages, which I never got to be very strong in, but obviously has become a huge area now. You wouldn't have credit cards or bank checks or payrolls or social security or any of the rest of that without computers to run it. I was never very deeply involved in that. So that was a different issue for computers. But within the scientific area, there's from the beginning there was a dichotomy between research and instruction.
Now, within the College of Engineering itself, we talked a little bit before the interview today about the fact that a lot of these COE deans seem to serve for a pretty long time. You served in your entire years in the department. There were only three deans of the college: Kurt Wendt, Bob Marshall, and John Bullinger.
Right.
How did each of them rate in terms of computers and instruction and undergraduate?
Wendt was extremely helpful. He helped us get started in the first place. I could always get a sympathetic ear with him when I went to talk. I told you the time that he said, I've been playing poker up in the president's office and I got some extra money, you want another computer.
Great phrase.
In Marshall's era, Marshall was more interested in research. But during his tenure, the associate dean, Bob Ratner, was the one I dealt with most, and he was extremely supportive and extremely helpful, listening to our needs, in particular our pleas for more financial support. That is, we'd be going along and find all of a sudden that we are stuck here, we need something else. I'd go up to Bob and say, can we get some money to do this? And he said, I don't know where, but I'll see what I can do, and he did. Bollinger tended to be a swing in the other direction. He has been much more interested in putting the university on the map in terms of research support and getting grants from a lot of places. His area in mechanical engineering before he became dean was much more in that direction as well. So he presided in my departure from ECL. I can't really blame him for that. I think he had a valid reason in that sense. You could hire somebody who could direct a computing lab for a lot less money than a full professor's salary. But he supported data acquisition simulation lab. The engineering research building had its own computer up on the top level. Vince was active in that area, as a matter of fact.
Vince Rideout.
Yeah, he can tell you more about that one. I know I was kind of resentful when they talked about getting this whole new computer to put up there rather than trying to consolidate ECL. And they said, well, this is going to be up on the 12th floor. We don't want the patter of thousands of undergraduate feet going through our place halls. Literally, that was one of the answers I got. So, yes, I've been supported by all of the deans, very much so. This thing couldn't have taken off if I hadn't had Harold Peterson, Vince Rideout, Kurt Wendt, Bob Ratner.
Yeah, there it is. I don't know if you have anything to say about this, but any comments, because I don't know what your associations were, but some of the chancellors who served during your time here were Fred Harrington, Robin Fleming, Ed Young, and Irv Shane, and there were little acting ones here and there. Did you get any impressions on the support or lack thereof on any of these people regarding computers and computing?
The chancellor or an assistant chancellor served as the chair of the all university computing committees, which I served on for several years. I got to know several of them through those activities.
I mentioned Harrington, Fleming, Ed Young. And
Harrington was before me, Fleming very slightly, Ed Young somewhat, Bry Curl somewhat. You got that list there. Where do you go? Shane probably got to know the closest in that regard. Sewell, no. Bry Curl somewhat. Ed Young, significantly. Pound, I don't know why. Oh, he never was
chancellor. He was acting chancellor just a year or so.
But Irv Shane, I did know quite well. And yes, he was very supportive. Young somewhat, I would say Shane was very supportive of computing.
You had something else you wanted to discuss?
Going back to the very active days of ECL, Nell Asmuth, the wife of John Asmuth, who after his work on the computer, he did the development work on the floating point circuitry.
Right, WISC, yeah.
Was teaching math out at Wisconsin Heights High School, which is out west of here, 20, 30 miles, and was trying to introduce her students to the idea of computers. And she would teach them a little bit of Fortran and bring them down to ECL, and I would give them a demonstration and let them run their programs through the machine there.
Great.
So again, I was trying to spread the gospel still more widely.
Well, when you, spreading the gospel, this is a good place to tie this in. Your wife has mentioned, discussed your retirement party a little bit and the master of ceremonies and how that went. I think that's kind of a good summation of some of the things you were interested in.
Well, they got various people to speak, including Larry Travis of Computer Sciences Department, who mentioned that when he was still out in California going to come to Wisconsin, one of the people he was associated with out there said, be sure and look up Charlie Davidson and the work he's doing on neurophysiology and computers and artificial intelligence, which I had done lightly in a seminar, never taught a course. But I do remember the master of ceremonies, Jim Skiles.
From electrical engineering.
Fellow electrical computer engineering, who had been in the power systems branch of the department, saying, well, we'll say this about Charlie. he managed to drag the department kicking and screaming into the computer age.
I love it. You have plenty of extracurricular activities that to keep you busy, and we had talked about them before, and I'd like you to just tell us about them for a couple of minutes. Some of them were back in the old days. Departments did a lot more to try to work on cohesion and try and a sense of spirit within the department, and you were certainly a central figure in that when it was EE. Could you talk about some of those things that you participated in and helped organize?
Well, in those days there were three department faculty who lived on Lake Monona. Art Tiedemann, block east of us, myself here, Norb Schmitz, who lived over what would be now, he got evicted when they put the Nolan Causeway.
Oh, yeah, right.
So we worked up the idea of having a joint water festival, having water skiing, sailing, paddling, swimming, lots of those activities at our various three houses, and then converge on the home of one of us to have a big picnic supper. Mm. And that went on, 10 or 12 years. We would have an annual water festival for it. Let's see, it would be either at the Schmitz Marina or Shea Tiedemann or the Davidson Downs, rotating one or the other around. We would have 50, 60 people, including families, of course, and kids. We would have to make sure we had people tabbed to be lifeguards and checking out equipment and that type of stuff. So the water festivals were a lot of fun.
Oh yeah,
people got to know
wonderful spirit, yeah.
Another side activity was the square dances. I had gotten started in square dancing before I got into electrical engineering, and in fact, before we were married, I will mention in passing, I met my wife, Hermine, when I signed up for the square dance calling class she was teaching for the recreation department. And we did a lot of square dance promoting in the neighborhood, out at church, and we started having electrical Christmas engineering square dance during the Christmas holidays here, and we could fit two squares into this living room.
It's a big living room. Yes.
One reason why we keep this type of flooring so that you can dance on it. And that went on 21 years.
Oh my goodness.
Again, a cohesive, fun-loving, get-to-know-each-other type affair. Yeah. We'll also throw in that Marion Peterson, Harold's wife, did a tremendous job of maintaining spirit, esprit de corps among the wives of the department by having regular get-togethers with just the wives.
Oh, that's great.
And in fact, she knit a sweater for every one of the children as they came along.
There are not that many instances I can think of where the women actually had their own organizations within the department. What kind of activities did Mrs. Peterson arrange? Was it just social, mainly
social
type things?
Lunch, tea, no social program type of thing. Mm-hmm. Just get together, chat, get acquainted, and so on.
Now, when you had your square dances here, how many years? 21 years, did you say? Did you do the calling?
Yeah.
Can you call us right now? Do a call right now?
I haven't in years, but sure, put on a record.
Oh.
Bow to your partner. Bow to your corner. Head to couples. Forward and back. Head to couples. Right and left through. Head to couples. Right and left back. Side to couples. Right and left through. Side two couples, right and left back. The head two couples to a lady, chain. The side two couples do the same. Head two couples, chain right back. Side two couples, chain.